reading today is continuing on through Exodus, and we're reading from Exodus chapter 5. I'm going to read right through to 6 verse 5, so we get a feel of what's going on. Moses has arrived in Egypt and is about to challenge Pharaoh. After Moses and Aaron went to Pharaoh and said, "This is what the Lord, the God of Israel, says. Let my people go so that they may hold a festival to me in the wilderness." Pharaoh said, "Who is the Lord that I should obey him and let Israel go? I do not know the Lord, and I will not let Israel go." Then they said, "The God of the Hebrews has met with us. Now let us take a 3-day journey into the wilderness to offer sacrifices to the Lord our God, or he may strike us with plagues or with the sword." But the king of Egypt said, "Moses and Aaron, why are you taking the people away from their labor? Get back to your work." Then Pharaoh said, "Look, the people of the land are now numerous, and you are stopping them from working." The same day Pharaoh gave this order to the slave drivers and overseers in charge of the people: "You are no longer to supply the people with straw for making bricks. Let them go and gather their own straw, but require them to make the same number of bricks as before. Don't reduce the quota. They are lazy. That is why they are crying out, 'Let us go and sacrifice to our God.' Make the work harder for them so that they keep working and pay no attention to lies." Then the slave drivers and the overseers went out and said to the people, "This is what Pharaoh says: I will not give you any more straw. Go and get your own straw, wherever you can find it, but your work will not be reduced at all." So the people scattered all over Egypt to gather stubble to use for straw. The slave drivers kept pressing them, saying, "Complete the work required of you for each day, just as when you had straw." And Pharaoh's slave drivers beat the Israelite overseers they had appointed, demanding, "Why haven't you met your quota of bricks yesterday or today as before?" Then the Israelite overseers went and appealed to Pharaoh, "Why have you treated your servants this way? Your servants are given no straw, yet are told, 'Make bricks.' Your servants are being beaten, but the fault is with your own people." Pharaoh said, "Lazy, that's what you are, lazy. That is why you keep saying, 'Let us go and sacrifice to the Lord.' Now get to work. You will not be given any straw, yet you must produce your full quota of bricks." The Israelite overseers realized they were in trouble when they were told, you are not to reduce the number of bricks required of you for each day. When they left Pharaoh, they found Moses and Aaron waiting to meet them, and they said, "May the Lord look on you and judge you. You have made us obnoxious to Pharaoh and his officials and have put a sword in their hand to kill us." Moses returned to the Lord and said, "Why, Lord, why have you brought trouble on this people? Is this why you sent me? Ever since I went to Pharaoh to speak in your name, he has brought trouble on this people, and you have not rescued your people at all." Then the Lord said to Moses, "Now you will see what I will do to Pharaoh. Because of my mighty hand, he will let them go. Because of my mighty hand, he will drive them out of his country." God said to Moses, "I am the Lord. I appeared to Abraham, to Isaac, and to Jacob as God Almighty, but by my name, the Lord, I did not make myself known to them. I also established my covenant with them to give them the land of Canaan where they reside as foreigners. Moreover, I have heard the groaning of the Israelites, whom the Egyptians are enslaving, and I have remembered my covenant." When I was 11 years old, I watched my first Olympic Games, 1984. You can now work out how old I am. And it was the first Olympic Games that I had really been excited about. Firstly, because it was in Los Angeles. And when I was 11, I was like, well, Los Angeles is the place to be, because America, that's where everything comes from, isn't it? This is what I thought. So I was very excited, especially when the man zoomed in on his jet-powered pack, if you remember the 1984 Olympics. But I was also very excited because Britain, for the first time in however many years people could remember, had a young woman athlete who could rival the Americans. 3,000-meter runner. She hadn't started off as a British citizen. She was South African. But she had been adopted in quite controversial circumstances a few months before, possibly because she was the world record holder at the 3,000 metres. And she was now a British citizen. And she was going to race for us. She was the woman of the day. And she was going to rival the American sweetheart, Mary Decker. The name of this woman, of course, was Zola Budd. She ran in bare feet, which for all of us was a novelty, and we were all very excited about that for some bizarre reason. And there was lots of things going on. Would it hurt her feet? How does she do it? But anyway, that was an aside. And we were very excited because here was the clash. Zola Budd versus Mary Decker. For once, we had a hope. What was going to happen? Well, it was in Los Angeles, so we had to set our alarms to go off at about 3 o'clock in the morning. Everyone was told what time the race would be on. My mum set up a little black and white telly in the bedroom, so we didn't have to go very far. And we set the alarm, and it went off, and we all got up and we sat on the bed. What was going to happen? Well, a few minutes into the race, probably seconds, there was a clash. Not the one we were expecting. Zola Budd and Mary Decker bumped into each other. Mary Decker tripped over Zola Budd's bare feet and fell to the side, grasping her hip in agony, rolling over in Hollywood style. She was probably injured, to be fair, but you know. And Zola Budd then was booed for the rest of the race and came in a dismal seventh. We were gutted, disappointed. All our hopes and desires and dreams of beating the world's best, the Americans, was in tatters. For me, and a lot of the British public at the time, the Los Angeles Olympics was a huge disappointment because we'd expected so much and it had turned into a complete failure. And, you know, it's not like we're unfamiliar with disappointment, is it? We've had it many times over the years. 30 years of hurt, blah, 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 blah. We're always getting disappointments in sport. But, you know, it's when you have hoped for so much, when you have dreamed that something would happen, when you have expected it to turn out really well, when the papers have built it up, that it's such a difficult thing to take. And you see here, when we get to Exodus chapter 5, we have this kind of situation. Because here, the Israelites, the people of God, are, well, for want of a better word, desperate. They're desperate people. In fact, they're more than desperate. Because they've been in Egypt now for 400 years. And that meant 400 years of slavery. 400 years of working in bad conditions. 400 years of laboring for harsh authorities. Of listening to commands from other people, of watching their own people die. 400 years of watching one nation succeed while their nation seemed to go down the drain. 400 years of living under another regime. Living under the leading power of the day, watching this other nation succeed. And they're convinced that nothing is ever going to change. Convinced that Egypt are always going to win everything. Convinced that the balance of power is never going to be swayed. Because it's been like this for 400 years. There is no hope, really. So at the end of chapter 4, when Moses and Aaron arrive and bring together all the elders of Israel, and tell them everything the Lord has said to Moses about his rescue plan and perform signs before the people to prove this. You can imagine there's a sense of excitement here. I mean, here, finally, after 400 years, there's a little bit of hope. It's as if God has actually remembered his people. The Lord that they groaned to in their slavery a few chapters before, the one they cried out to for help, the Lord, the God of Israel, has finally remembered them. And not only that, he sent Moses to rescue them. Someone who is competent in the ways of Pharaoh. Someone who was educated as an Egyptian. Someone who has experienced the life that their captors experience every day. Someone who could go head to head with the leading power of the day and possibly win. Someone who the Israelites could finally put their hope in. I mean, sure, you know, Moses was a bit of an outsider. He was from another country. He was originally Hebrew, though, and, you know, to be sure the people needed all the help they could get. So they weren't going to go through that technicality. That was fine. Because, you know, the important thing was that finally there was a sense of hope, excitement, a sense that things were going to get better. Because finally the Israelites sensed that God could overturn the Egyptians through Moses, the Israelite version of Zola Budd. And then, what seems like a few minutes into the encounter, things go dramatically wrong. Because as Moses and Aaron come before Pharaoh, as they hit the front running, anticipating victory, as they boldly demand the release of the Israelites, as they stand there and say, "The God of the Hebrews has met with us. This is what the Lord, the God of Israel, says," Pharaoh surprises them. He does not give in. He does not bow down. He does not start shaking in fear. He doesn't fall to the trailing pack and disappear. He doesn't let the Israelites go and admit defeat as they were expecting. Instead, he has the audacity to make things worse. When faced with the might of God, the God of Israel, Pharaoh turns to Moses and to Aaron and he says to them, as bold as anything, "Who is the Lord that I should obey him? I do not know the Lord and I will not let Israel go." He turns to Moses and Aaron and he defies them. He defies them. And then he punishes the people. The people who have built up their hope, who have anticipated victory, who have sensed something good is going to happen, are punished. As Pharaoh orders them to do the same amount of work in the same amount of time with half the materials they're supposed to have. All their hopes, all their dreams, all their desires shattered in one huge big disappointment. And so it's no surprise, really, that in the chapter that we look at today, things seem to spiral out of control. Because as things get tougher and tougher and tougher for the Israelite people, they do what anyone would do in that situation. They start to fight among themselves. You know, they're told to work harder. Pharaoh's slave drivers beat the Israelite overseers. The Israelite overseers complain to Pharaoh, "Why are you doing this?" Pharaoh blames the people, "You're lazy." The people of Israel are ordered to work harder, so the overseers go and blame Moses. And then Moses, in turn, blames God. "Why, Lord? Why have you brought trouble on this people? Is this why you sent me? You have not rescued your people at all." As things get tougher and tougher and tougher and targets are not met and ideas are not realised and expectations are not fulfilled and the things the Israelites thought would happen do not happen, the people of God blame their leaders and the leaders in turn blame God. And Pharaoh's regime is secure once more. Until that is, we get to chapter 6, where God changes the focus completely. Because you see, as Moses comes to God, full of the complaints of the people, ready to enter into one of his long arguments that we discussed last week, feeling justified that he can come to God and pass the blame because it's God's fault, God says, "I've heard the groanings of the Israelites, whom the Egyptians are enslaving. And I have remembered my covenant. I have remembered my covenant." You see, as Moses comes before God with all the complaints of the people, God shifts the focus. He doesn't look at who's to blame. He doesn't discuss what expectations have not been fulfilled. He doesn't want to say who did what wrong. God doesn't enter into a bitter discussion to try and sort it out. Instead, he points his people to the long-forgotten covenant. The covenant. The covenant he made with Abraham, where God promised to be committed to his people, where God promised to be loyal to his people, where God promised to live with his people forever, where God promised to enter into an unending special relationship with his people. Through good times, through bad times, through the toughest times they'll ever face, where God promised to be faithful. You see, as Moses comes with complaints before God about how things are not working, God points to what is really important. His unending relationship with his people and the relationship that they need to have with each other. Do you know, it makes me think a little bit about one of Simon's heroes, Ernest Shackleton, an explorer. Wouldn't surprise you, would it? Explorer doing long walks in the cold, Simon's hero. Shackleton, many of you may know, was a man who did a lot of expeditions. And one thing that he dreamed of doing was reaching the South Pole. That's what he wanted to do. One of the things, he did a lot of things, but one of the things he wanted to do was reach the South Pole. And he had tried to reach the South Pole once and failed in Robert Scott's expedition. He'd been unwell and had to leave and go home. And he was trying again. In 1907, he boarded a boat called the Nimrod, a boat, a ship, not like a dinghy, a ship called the Nimrod, and he set out for the Antarctic. And he reached there in 1908. And he set up camp with a lot of men, and they were doing experiments and finding out different things. And then he decided, after about 8 or 9 months, that he was going to set out with a small group for the South Pole. And they set out with their ponies, or donkeys, I'm not sure what animal it would be. And they went along, and they were determined this time to reach the South Pole. But things didn't go as planned, as these expeditions always do. And one of the men got kicked in the knee quite badly injured. That was a problem. They started to run out of food. They had to shoot one of the animals to eat it. They had to survive. The winds were against them. It was a bitter journey. And they got to within 97 miles of the South Pole. Considering that they'd gone over 1,000, it was quite a good achievement. But Shackleton had a decision to make. Was he going to push that 97 miles to get his dream, to reach the thing that he'd always wanted to reach? Was he going to risk the lives of his men to be the one that got to the South Pole? Or was he going to be known as the man who never reached the South Pole and turned back just 97 miles from it? Shackleton made a decision that day that affected the lives of his men and their families, and how he was seen. He decided to turn round. He decided to go back. He decided to forget about his dream and to think about the people in his expedition. And it was a hard journey back, but they made it. They all survived. They failed dismally. They didn't reach the South Pole, but they all lived, and they all got back onto the ship, the Nimrod. You see, for Shackleton, it seemed that ultimately relationships were the most important thing to him. People's lives. People who he could care for and look after, rather than his dream. He put people first. And you know, this is exactly what God brings into focus in the middle of the Israelites' terrible suffering here in Exodus. When they're moaning and groaning and fighting and blaming and trying to sort things out, God highlights the kind of God that he is. And therefore, he highlights the kind of people that his people should be. A people who care about people, a people who care about relationships. A people who put that first. And you know, I don't know about you, but when I read this, I find that quite challenging. I find it quite challenging for the church today because, you know, today it's quite easy to get disappointed, isn't it? It's quite easy to be disappointed in things. I mean, you know, we come here every week and we focus on how God is an almighty God. We've talked about that today. We focus on about how God is a caring God. We talk about how God is an ever-present God, how God is here among us. He's here with us. And we talk about how this God who's here with us today is the same God who was with the Israelites way back in the Bible. And we get excited about this, don't we? Excited that our God is a God who's here. We say, you know, Jesus says in the Bible, "Here I am. I stand at the door and knock. If anyone hears my voice and opens the door, I will come in and eat with them and them with me." A wonderful promise of Jesus. And we say, this is real. Because God is real, because he is alive, he's here today. He's not a myth, he's not a tradition, he's not a story. He's our God and he's here with us right now. He's committed to us and we are his people. We have hope, we say, because the God who was the God of Israel is our God and he's here with us now. And we talk about this. And yet often, although we talk about this and we know this, in reality, this knowledge doesn't always seem to make a difference. In fact, sometimes it seems to make things worse. You know, people around us don't always recognise this God. They don't know the God we're talking about. Things that we want to happen in the world don't happen. It doesn't work out the way we think it should work out if God's here today. The life that we think we should have because God is alive and among us, we don't have. Our problems don't disappear. The church that we expect doesn't function the way that we think it should function when God is here. The leaders that we have appointed, well, they're not doing very well, are they? I was expecting this. Yes. We have these targets, you know, we have these ideas, we have these expectations, and sometimes they're not fulfilled. They don't happen. They're not what we think they should be. What we have been looking forward to when God is here among us doesn't seem to happen. And often life seems to get tougher and tougher and tougher and tougher until the temptation is to fight amongst ourselves, just like the Israelites did in the passage that we've read. Until eventually we can find someone who is to blame for why things aren't how we expect them to be. But you see, the thing that's so challenging about this passage today is that actually we have a covenant God. You know, we have a God who is faithful. We have a God who is loyal. We have a God who is with us. We have a God who is committed to relationship. And that means that if we have this kind of God, then we are to be a covenant people. We are to be a covenant people. If we have a covenant God, we're to be a covenant people. You know, a people who are faithful to God and to each other. A people who are loyal to God and to each other. A people who are committed to God and to each other. We need to be a people who are committed to relationships above everything else. Above everything else. In other words, today, we need to be a people who live differently to others. A people who put God and each other first. There's a story, it's a children's story, quite a famous one, about people who are different. And it's about a young boy who was sitting listening to his granddad speak to him one night. And his granddad used to be a soldier in the Austrian army. And his son said, "Oh, tell me, Grandad, tell me about one of your famous victories." And his granddad said, "Oh, well, you know, I don't really want to tell you about that, but I'll tell you one of my greatest defeats." And the boy was like, "Oh, okay, well, go ahead." And he said, "You see, one day we were marching in the Tyrol region of Austria. It was a hard region, a region where people weren't being defeated. We couldn't defeat them." And he said, "As we were marching along, someone came to us and I said, 'How's it going? How's it going?' And he said, 'There's one village that will not be defeated. they have an invincible leader. And this granddad said, oh, well, okay, let's get some more troops. They got some more troops in. Let's double our strength and march on this town. So they doubled their strength. They marched on the town. And as they marched towards the town, they saw people in the fields going about their daily work. Children playing in the streets. And the soldiers thought, well, maybe they're not prepared for us. Or it's a trick. It's a trick. Let's double our strength. So they doubled their strength once more and they continued to march into the town. And as they marched into the town, there was people in the doorways saying, hello, hello, welcome, hello. And he thought, this is getting a bit embarrassing, but let's continue. It's a trick. So they carried on marching and little children would come up to the soldiers going, hello, 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 handing them things, little presents. And the soldier's going, oh, that's just like my little grandson at home. And the man was getting a bit embarrassed, but he said, we've got to continue to march. And they marched to the centre of the village, to where the invincible leader was. And out of the town hall came this little old man. And the soldier went, have you not got an army? And the man went, no. But I see you have. He said, yeah. He said, well, what are you going to fight with? He said, we're not going to fight. He said, we're not here to fight. He said, we don't follow that kind of lifestyle. He said, what do you mean? He said, well, we are a people who follow Jesus. And Jesus was a person who cared about people. So we're not going to fight you. We don't hate you. But if you want to take this town, you can take this town. And the soldier realized that he couldn't order any of his men to fire on these children or these women or these men who were in the streets, because no one would do it, because they weren't hostile. No one would do it. They couldn't fire on a child that looked like their grandchild, on people who had come and said hello to them. And so they made the decision to turn around and walk away, their greatest defeat, because this town had an invincible leader. His name was Jesus. And people had chosen to live differently because they'd chosen to follow him. And you know, today, in a society where backbiting and blame and arguments and pushing people out are part and parcel of what goes on, we as a covenant people need to live as a covenant people. However bad things get, we need to live differently. Because it's only when we live as God intended, it's only when we truly value our relationships with each other and our relationship with God above anything else, and therefore live differently, that people will really see the depth of what we have in the God that we worship. And I believe it's only when we're different and when we put each other first and value relationships above all else that other people will look at us and actually want a part of what we've got. Let's pray together.